Inflation has been slowing down, but how long till we get back to a rate we can live with? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, the 12th of December. Good to have you with us on this CPI Eve. That's right. Tomorrow, we'll get the latest read on inflation with the release of the Consumer Price Index for November. Then on Wednesday, we'll learn what the Fed plans to do about it. Analysts are expecting another interest rate increase, though maybe a smaller one this time, after several months of high but slowing price growth. As of the last reading, annual inflation was running at 7.7%. But fighting inflation is a long race. And as Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports, the last mile may be much harder than the first.
Grappling with inflation is a marathon, but it starts off as a sprint.
Areas where it's very normal to have frequent price changes, we've seen inflation already come down dramatically.
Laura Veldkamp is a professor of economics at Columbia.
So at the gas pump, for example.
And the inflation that was a direct result of the pandemic. Everyone buying goods online, supply chains breaking, all that is evening out. Adobe reports online prices, for example, which lean heavily towards goods, actually fell 3% in November. Freight rates have come down by 2/3 in a year. That kind of stuff should bring overall inflation down pretty fast.
I think there's a good chance we'll be down to 4% by the end of 2023, and maybe sooner than that.
But then there's everything else. Sarah House is a senior economist with Wells Fargo.
Getting inflation all the way back down to 2% on a sustained basis, that's going to require a cooler labor market.
Labor is most businesses' number one cost by far, House says.
Until you get labor costs growing at a slower pace that looks more consistent with the Fed's 2% target, you're still going to have an elevated pace of inflation.
Wages have increased the most at the lower end of the income spectrum, even outpacing inflation for some people.
Which is, from a social perspective, a very good thing.
Marcus Brunnermeier is a professor of economics at Princeton. So wage inequality is shrinking a bit.
But it also means, as low-income workers often work in the service sector, there is more price pressure. So inflation in the service sector will potentially stay higher for a longer time.
But right now, a lot of people are pushing for wage increases just to keep up with the inflation we've already had, let alone what's coming. That is a tough cycle to break. So how long will it take to get back down to 2% inflation? Experts say years. It will take years. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Among the items on the to-do list for Congress before the end of the year and the political reshuffling after the midterm elections are several proposals to improve the retirement savings of Americans. Known collectively as the Secure Act 2.0, the bills are an effort to build on legislation passed during the Trump administration. And with bipartisan support, they actually stand a good chance of passing in some form. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more.
This latest package of bills might be most beneficial for those who are already saving something for retirement, but not enough, says Steve Rosenthal, a senior fellow at the Tax Policy Center.
It's oriented towards giving incentives to those who have the money to participate.
Several of the bill's provisions are aimed at widening tax benefits for people who are able to put money away for the future. But there are some proposals that could help the one in four Americans who aren't saving anything, says Alicia Manel, director of the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. One would automatically enroll qualifying employees in new 401k-type plans unless they opt out.
No one can say, oh, I'm going to put aside some money each month, because there's always some expense that seems more pressing.
There's also a proposal for tax credits for low-income workers making contributions. But Manel says the legislation fails to address the biggest challenge to retirement security in the U.S.
Coverage, coverage, coverage.
About half of all workers in the U.S. have no access to employer-sponsored retirement plans. The bills do aim to provide easier and cheaper ways for businesses to offer retirement plans, but many in the most need can't afford to deduct anything from their paychecks, says Richard Johnson, a senior fellow at the Urban Institute.
Those who lack a plan tend to be lower educated workers, lower income workers, part-time workers, disproportionately people of color.
They're more likely to rely on Social Security, which is headed for depletion starting in 2035. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a little rally before the Fed meeting. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Lunar New Year is almost here. It's the most important holiday on the Chinese calendar, falling on January 22nd in 2023. Over the past 3 years, celebrations have been pretty muted. China's zero COVID policy has kept many people from moving within the country. In recent days, the government has been loosening its rules, including dropping the requirement for negative PCR tests to travel domestically. But years of restrictions have tested family bonds, especially among those who work miles away from their families, like factory workers who manufacture cheap stuff for us to buy. Here's our China correspondent Jennifer Pak with one man's story.
The Lunar New Year is like Thanksgiving and Christmas all rolled into one. It's big. Even bigger for folks like factory worker Xie Yifei. He works in southern China's Shenzhen, while his wife and children live in a different city with his in-laws.
I usually go home once a year during the Lunar New Year holiday. I don't see my family at other times because it isn't easy to ask for leave at the factory. Also, I wanted to work more to earn more.
He saw his wife and sons as usual in January 2020. But 2021 was a different story. The COVID-19 virus was becoming more contagious.
That Lunar New Year, my wife and I worried about our children catching COVID because their immune systems are weak. They stayed with my mother-in-law instead. Only me and my wife went back to my hometown to visit my mother.
Another year passed, and his son said, "We've not seen our father in 2 years. We don't need him." So ahead of the Lunar New Year this past February, Xie Yifei reunited with his family. He met his wife and children at the Guangzhou rail station, and together they headed to his hometown in neighboring Guangxi province. This was no easy feat.
When I was preparing to go back to my hometown, the village cadre called and said, "Don't come home for the Lunar New Year," because Shenzhen had medium-risk areas.
He says the area where he lives in Shenzhen was not one of them at the time, but that didn't sway village officials. They said if he came back, he'd have to quarantine in a government facility for at least 12 days at his own cost, but he took the gamble anyway. At last count, there are 171 million people in China who left their hometowns for jobs. Their sacrifices are the reason Americans can buy cheaper products. But it's not easy for them to work away from their families. An online video shows a son grabbing onto his mother in eastern Anhui province. "Mama, don't go," says the boy. "I don't want money. I just want mom." But people who come from the countryside can't just move with their families. There's a sort of internal passport system that allows them to work in big cities but not settle there. Again, Xie Yifei.
"If my kids are in Shenzhen with me, they won't qualify for free public school. They'd have to go to a private school. I can't afford that."
While COVID has forced people in the U.S. to rethink their work situations, Xie Yifei doesn't have the same luxury.
"My life is kind of miserable, but I have no choice. I can't live like my father's generation and grow crops at home, because that doesn't earn enough. But it doesn't feel like home where I work. So I have a home I can return to, and there's not a home for me in the place I live in."
In the end, Xie Yifei did make it to his hometown with his family last February without having to quarantine. On the trip home, he shot a video of him checking his son's homework. They sound like a regular family. But off camera, Xie Yifei says things felt different.
"When I saw my sons, it felt like we were strangers. I'd ask them questions, but they didn't really say much. It felt like they didn't know me.
It's been 10 months since then. Xie Yifei says he's got another chance to reconnect with his sons for the Lunar New Year in January, COVID restrictions or not. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
Hurricane season is officially over, and numbers-wise, it was a fairly average one, with 14 named tropical storms this year, three of them making landfall as hurricanes in the U.S. mainland and Puerto Rico. Average numbers, of course, don't tell the whole story, and Florida is still recovering from the devastation of hurricanes Ian and Nicole, hitting just 6 weeks apart. Climate change and a boom in coastal development are making storms more destructive and more deadly. For our podcast, How We Survive, I spent some time this fall talking with people who use technology to estimate the risk and potential damage of such disasters. Today, we hear how the climate crisis is complicating their jobs. A bookshelf in Dan Ward's office is full of titles like An Introduction to Dynamic Meteorology and Programmer's Guide to Fortran 90. I love it. So it's a combination of like software or computer coding and meteorology.
Yeah, which is a great description of what we do.
Dan is an atmospheric scientist and director of model development at Karen Clark & Company in Boston. And he designs computer models that calculate the damage and risk of future damage from natural disasters, mostly for insurance companies. I met him in late September as Hurricane Ian was barreling across Florida. Based on the track of the storm, the model could predict how buildings would hold up at different wind speeds.
And it gets extremely complicated because there's tons of different types of buildings, and they can have garage doors, they can have different shaped roofs that all impact the damage that can occur from a particular wind speed.
Lately, there's another big variable to consider. What role can we guess or do we know that climate change plays in something like that?
I could talk to you for a very long time about that.
While Dan says we can't attribute any one storm to climate change, scientists are confident that warming temperatures are producing more intense hurricanes, higher storm surge from sea level rise, and more rainfall. And that's just hurricanes.
Climate change really impacts all of the atmospheric perils that we model that are of importance to the insurance industry. Think wildfires in the western U.S. or floods not related to hurricanes as well are impacted by climate change.
There's always uncertainty in computer models, but Karen Clark, the company's co-founder and a pioneer in catastrophe modeling, says recent advances in climate science have made it possible to better predict how warming will affect the severity of disasters.
The science is at a state where we are able to quantify the impacts on extreme events. It took a while.
For example, she says for every 1 degree Celsius increase in temperature,
you get a 2.5% increase in wind speeds. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot, but losses increase exponentially with wind speeds.
And that, she says, makes the catastrophe models even more important so that insurance companies and government officials can be prepared when a disaster happens and do more to prevent damage in the future. You can hear more of How We Survive at marketplace.org or wherever you listen to podcasts. Coming up.
We've come so far. It's like you have to remember how far we've come in a couple of years.
And yet, so far to go. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 528 points, almost 1.6%, finished at 34,005. The NASDAQ added 139 points, a little over 1.25%, to end at 11,143. And the S&P 500 found 56 points, 1.4%, to land at 3,990. Microsoft is buying a 4% stake in London Stock Exchange Group, PLC. It's part of a deal for the software company to help one of the world's oldest exchanges migrate into cloud computing. Shares in Microsoft gained 2.9%. Shares in London Stock Exchange Group picked up just shy of 3%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.61%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. There used to be an Irish pub in my neighborhood. Now it's an urgent care center, one of seven within about 3 miles. Maybe you've noticed this too. Urgent care clinics are popping up in communities everywhere, and there's been an influx of investment with big names like Amazon acquiring One Medical. So what's all this going to mean for patients? Marketplace's Kristen Schwab reports.
When you think of a last-minute doctor's visit, you probably don't think of a pleasant experience. But the waiting room at Northwell Health's Urgent Care Center on Manhattan's Upper West Side feels a bit spa-like, with leather chairs and beige stone backsplash. Neil Shipley is the company's New York medical director.
You'll see lots of rounded edges and, you know, it's supposed to be warm and inviting and welcoming.
Maybe more important to the experience is what patients don't see, the center's in-house lab. 10 machines are busy running COVID tests. That's that fan-like noise you hear in the background. The technology is so compact, the size of a brick, they almost look like toys.
Wow, we've come so far. It's like you have to remember how far we've come in a couple of years.
So this kind of thing used to only be able to be done in an analyzer that would like take up the space of like a classroom, right? And now it's literally the size of a handheld device.
Urgent care centers became a critical piece of the healthcare system during the pandemic, partly because of COVID testing and treatment, and also because at one point, besides overstretched emergency rooms, urgent care was one of the few places people could go for a sprained wrist or a UTI.
We did our best to sort of protect the rest of the healthcare system and keep people out of the emergency departments. And when primary care offices were closed at the time and emergency departments were overwhelmed, we did stay open.
There are more than 11,000 urgent care facilities in the U.S., compared to 4,000 emergency rooms. And urgent care is expanding. Lou Ellen Horowitz, CEO of the Urgent Care Association, says the industry grows around 10% each year because it's become a business opportunity.
The mega companies, if you want to call them that.
Chains like Concentra, MedExpress, and CityMD.
Is a relatively new phenomenon. And what really made all of that possible was private equity interest in the space.
Private equity realizes urgent care is a gap filler for the uninsured, who pay on average a tenth of what they would at the ER, and for the growing number of people who don't have a primary care physician.
There's also a time access that we fulfill that I'm sick and I need to get in to see my primary care doctor for, but I can't get an appointment for 3 weeks.
That's because there aren't enough of them. Experts say the country will face a shortage of up to 55,000 PCPs in the next decade. Ari Friedman, an ER doctor and health economist at the University of Pennsylvania, worries people have become too reliant on urgent care and are skipping preventative health care.
There's this idea of like the longitudinal relationship with your primary care doctor, right? Where you just don't just see somebody once, you see them kind of over and over and over again, and that builds a relationship.
A relationship with someone who notices that you've been complaining about your back for a year or that you're overdue for a colonoscopy. Urgent cares associated with hospital systems shrug off this criticism. They say patients are more likely to stay within the system, and urgent care doctors can refer them to their own specialists, which is also how they make money, a pyramid of referrals. Friedman says independent practices rely on churn, a large volume of flu shots and strep tests. And the problem with this is that to make money, clinics tend to open in wealthier communities.
The model has a huge amount of potential, but we need to put urgent care in places where they're increasing access.
That's lower income neighborhoods and rural areas, which already suffer from healthcare shortages. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
We talked earlier about hurricanes. Well, believe it or not, 2022 has been a pretty quiet year for another kind of climate-related disaster, wildfires. But the odds are that next year won't be. As the planet warms, wildfires are becoming more frequent and more extreme, and the cost is growing too. A new report from the Pew Charitable Trust says federal spending on wildfire management has doubled over the last decade. Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports on how state and local governments are faring.
Fighting wildfires is expensive. Take those airplanes that fly over them and drop that red fire retardant.
When I was a firefighter, I used to think that was the coolest thing. Now all I see is dollar bills flinging out of the bottom of the airplane.
George Geisler is the state forester in Washington now. And he says just one load of that fire retardant can cost up to $10,000. And the airplane itself?
It could cost you $1,000 to $2,000, $3,000 an hour just when the propellers are spinning.
And that's just a tiny fraction of the total cost of wildfires.
The Outdoor Shakespeare Festival in Oregon was canceled, and it is millions of tourism dollars in this one small community.
And all the lost tax revenue that goes with it. There's also the damage to natural resources and forests.
Our watersheds are getting burned up. The water quality goes into the toilet, literally. And then what happens is you have to spend more money to purify water and prepare it for human consumption.
All sorts of costs are rising as climate change makes wildfires more frequent and more destructive.
For many, many years and decades, really, those other costs that come to the surface following a wildfire event have been overlooked.
Kimiko Barrett, a wildfire researcher at Headwaters Economics, says that's starting to change. State and local governments are now thinking and talking more about the need to keep track of everything.
With respect to damage and the costs that are associated, not just for suppression, but what we're seeing with these rebuilding efforts.
But really getting the full picture is complicated. There are so many different costs associated with fighting and recovering from wildfires, and with trying to prevent them. And they're borne by lots of different agencies at different levels of government at different times. There are some numbers that give a sense of how much wildfire-related costs have been rising. Federal spending by the two main agencies that manage wildfires, the Department of the Interior and the Forest Service, has doubled in the last decade. Colin Ford, a lead author on the Pew study, says state spending data is harder to get.
But to give one example, Washington's average annual spending on wildfires more than tripled when you compare the first half of the 2010s to the second half.
In many states, Ford says, all of the increased costs are starting to put a strain on budgets more broadly, because most of the money states spend on wildfires comes from the same pot they use to pay for everything else.
So when a big fire happens, that's inherently taking away from other priorities in the state budget, things that affect people's everyday lives. Things like human services, K-12 education, healthcare.
That's true of other climate-related disasters too, including hurricanes and floods. But Ching Miao at the Rochester Institute of Technology says disasters don't affect all communities in the same way.
There is very substantial social disparity in disaster recovery and responses.
A recent study she did, focusing on county governments, found low-income communities tend to lose more tax revenue than wealthy communities do after disasters. And they tend to get less state and federal aid.
So the current system does not seem to really support their recovery.
Low-income communities also tend to get less federal funding for mitigation projects that would make them less vulnerable to future disasters. The first step to changing that, she says, is knowing more about how much governments are actually spending and where the money's going. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace. This final note on the way out today, with a hat tip to Bloomberg. People spending with credit cards or borrowing to buy a house aren't the only ones feeling the pinch of higher interest rates. The U.S. Treasury Department said today that the interest paid on the public debt, as in Treasury securities, in October and November, added up to more than $102 billion. That's about 87% higher than the same period last year. And here's your moment of economic context. Sabri got us going with inflation, and that's where we'll end. We've told you before that expectations can actually drive inflation. And according to the latest survey from the New York Fed, American consumers are expecting less of it. Respondents to the November survey of consumer expectations predicted prices would rise 5.2% in the coming year, the lowest reading since August 2021. Again, actual inflation, the October CPI, was 7.7%. Our daily production team includes Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Nicholas Giong, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. And I'm Amy Scott. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.